You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So the End of Life Choice Referendum is a public vote about whether the End of Life Choice Act 2019 should become part of New Zealand's legislation. The Act would give people with a terminal illness the option of requesting assisted dying. Assisted dying or voluntary euthanasia means that a person suffering with a terminal illness is helped to end their own life by a doctor administering a lethal dose. Currently, under New Zealand law, assisting someone to die is a criminal offence. It is considered aiding and abetting suicide under the Crimes Act 1961 and is punishable up to 14 years in prison. For this referendum, we are not voting on whether we agree or disagree with assisted dying as a concept. Instead, we are voting on whether the Act, as it stands, should become a part of our law. The specific wording of the questions voters will be asked is, do you support the End of Life Choice Act 2019 coming into force? We wanted to look into some of the issues that surround the End of Life Choice referendum and assisted dying, so we will be getting onto that now. To explain the End of Life Choice Act 2019, I'll begin with a little bit of history about how the Act came to be. ACT Party leader David Seymour entered the End of Life Choice Bill into the Members Bill ballot in Parliament in 2015. It was drawn and read in Parliament for the first time in 2017, and after Select Committee deliberation and amendments, it was read for the second and third time in Parliament in 2019. Now let's talk about what the Act does. The Act allows for a person to request assisted dying as an option when they are terminally ill. However, in order for a person to be eligible for assisted dying, they must meet a number of requirements. Here is ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden explaining what these requirements are.
So this law in particular says that you have to be aged over 18 years or older, be a New Zealand citizen or permanent resident, suffering from a terminal illness likely to end your life within 6 months. You have to be in an advanced state of irreversible decline in physical capability. That means you have to be actively getting worse. You have to be experiencing unbearable suffering that can't be relieved in a manner that you consider tolerable, and you have to be mentally competent to make a decision. And two independent doctors have to come to the conclusion that you meet those eligibility criteria. And if you're deemed not sure whether you meet the mental competency requirement, there's a requirement to then refer you to a psychiatrist. So it's quite a strict and narrow law.
A person requesting assisted dying must meet all of these requirements. This means that people dealing with mental illness or a physical disability cannot access the Act if their condition is the only reason they are seeking euthanasia, because they must meet these requirements first and foremost. Also, in order to be deemed mentally capable to make an informed decision about assisted dying, a person must understand the information, remember it, weigh it up, and communicate their decision in some way. I asked Brooke about whether the requirements might mean that access to the Act is too narrow. Has there been concern about it being perhaps too narrow?
Yeah, certainly one of the disappointments for a lot of people who would like to see a form of assisted dying in the country is that the mental competency requirement. So a lot of people are concerned that as they get older they might have dementia and not be able to have the same dignity in their life that they experienced beforehand. And that's certainly something I've heard going around the country. But what's really important here is that we can be very clear that the person is making a decision for themselves, and we're not passing that decision on to, you know, a guardian who's able to make decisions for them. So having that mental competency requirement, I think, is really important. So we actually know that this is the will of that person and it's not someone else making a decision for them.
Brooke then explained the concerns about there not being enough of an access safeguard for those people with disabilities or mental illness, but also sort of on the opposite hand, concerns around excluding those with disabilities or mental illness due to the strict requirements of this Act.
You know, we did around 2 years travelling around the country listening to people and their concerns, and the bill did change before it became an Act. And one of the things was about the disability rights community. So we made it really explicit in the law that you can't access the bill just because you have a mental disorder or a mental illness, a disability of any kind, or just because of your age. So you have to be meeting all of those terminal illness, suffering, and mental competency requirements. But of course, it would be reproachable, in my view, to say that a person, just because they have a disability, cannot ever access this piece of legislation. So that's why it's in the law that you have to meet the terminal illness requirements. But if you do have a disability, that's no grounds for it to actually be valid for you as an option. But ultimately, anyone should be able to access this as a form of choice if they are suffering at the end of their lives.
So just to clarify that, because I think that's sort of perhaps what I'm confused about, is that if you say you do have a disability or a mental health issue, then on top of that you meet those other requirements, that means that you can still access the Act. You're not actually held back by the fact that you have a disability or a mental health problem.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot of people that could be considered to have disabilities. I think at any one time it's around 20 or 25% of the population who are classified as having a form of disability. I think it's really important that we're not excluding people like that, because there's a man that I talked to, Philip Paxton, and he's a huge disability rights advocate, and he says to exclude people with disabilities from this Act would actually be going against generations of a push to acknowledge that people with disabilities should have choices like all other New Zealanders. So this is saying that there is a very strict requirement about all of the different eligibility criteria that you must meet, but we are not excluding people just because they have a disability.
Brooke then explained what the referendum means and how the End of Life Choice Act will come into force.
So currently it's an Act, so it's the End of Life Choice Act. So that means that there's a piece of law that's already gone through the whole parliamentary process, and it's sitting right now on our statute books. And in one of the clauses, it just says that to actually pass, you know, in totality, it needs to be a binding referendum that 50% plus one person of the public wanting this law to actually come into force for the country. So on the 17th of October, you'll get your vote on who you want to represent you in Parliament, but also whether you want this law, as it stands, to actually come into force. So it's not a question really about whether people should or should not be dying. It's a question about whether a person who is already dying from a terminal illness and suffering bitterly at the end of their life should have a choice over how and when they die. And in my view, it's the right thing to do, because any one of us could face a bad death. And palliative care can work for many people with terminal illnesses, but unfortunately, it just doesn't work for all people. And currently, there's a small number of people who are forced to choose between a number of cruel choices, like refusing food and water, having a bit too much morphine, or suffering until the bitter end. And I think there needs to be another choice under a safe law, that someone who's competent, informed, and terminally ill should have another option.
So to recap how the referendum will work, following the referendum on the 17th of October, if 50% of voters plus one person votes yes in the End of Life Choice referendum, the End of Life Choice Act will come into effect 12 months after the final vote totals are announced. If 50% plus one vote no, then the Act will cease to exist. Now turning to the arguments for and against assisted dying and whether the End of Life Choice Act should become a part of our law, as the question is in the referendum. We'll begin with how the political parties stand on this issue. At the End of Life Choice Bill's third and final reading in Parliament, each MP voted on the bill as a conscience vote, meaning they did not have to follow the overriding views of their parties. The National Party voted 17 in favour and 38 against. The Labour Party was 33 in favour and 13 against. All members of the Green Party, New Zealand First and ACT voted in favour. The total vote was 69 members for and 51 against. And all current leaders of the parties voted in favour of the law. I spoke with Philippa Malpass, who is an Associate Professor of Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Auckland School of Medicine, about the motivations behind voting for the end-of-life choice referendum. Philippa has focused much of her research over the last decade on decision-making at the end of life within the context of assisted dying, and has looked deeply into the motivations for and against supporting euthanasia.
I think there's a lot, actually. We've done research with people who both support and oppose assisted dying, and the reasons that people support it are many. Some people have experienced the dying and death of somebody close to them and don't want that kind of death for themselves. There are other people who feel that this is a personal choice that they ought to have control over. So they might say something like, I have made really important decisions all my life about how my life's going to go, and this is simply another choice, another decision that I ought to have control over. People already actually have the right to stop any medical treatment at all, even if stopping that treatment or asking it to be withdrawn will hasten their dying. And so some people have argued that, in fact, the law that allows assisted dying is really an extension of that, that people already can make decisions about their medical treatment and care. And I think, too, some people are fearful of their possible future suffering, their fear of losing autonomy, becoming dependent on others. So they might also influence people's support of assisted dying.
The ACT Party's Brooke Van Velden also spoke on why she thinks the end-of-life choice referendum should be supported.
Yeah, I would just say for people listening in, this is a matter about choice for someone who is terminally ill, suffering at the end of their life, and wanting another option. And I think it's the right thing to do and the moral thing to do to give people choice, because we never know if it will end up being us.
Although there has been considerable support for the Act within the political parties in Parliament, there has also been a lot of discussion by the public about whether the Act as it stands is appropriate in the New Zealand context. A core issue that has been brought up by those who are concerned about the referendum or oppose the Act itself is the fact that the Act does not require family to be consulted about the decision to go through with assisted dying. Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party speaks on this issue.
Well, the input of the family is included if it's the will of the person. And this is a really important point, because under no other health law in New Zealand do we require people to be forced to talk with their family about their medical health. And that would breach a patient's privacy. But what the doctor has to do is ensure that you have had the opportunity to talk with your family, and they have to encourage you to talk about your wish with your family, friends and counsellors. But it's really important that if a person, you know, they might be estranged from their son or daughter, that when they're making this decision about a health matter, that they're not forced to bring that person into a conversation when they might never actually talk with them on a day-to-day or even year-to-year basis. So I think having the doctor encourage you to do that is really important, but also allowing it to recognise that not everybody has a happy family situation where they talk openly about these things with each other.
Another relevant issue is that people are worried about the law being abused, whether that be by medical practitioners or family using coercion. I spoke to Philippa Malpass from the University of Auckland Medical School about this issue.
So when we spoke to some older people about why they oppose assisted dying, these are people who
said that they opposed it. They were fearful that, or very concerned that the law might become abused, that it might be abused in the future. So they worried about what's often termed a slippery slope, where the law will allow for certain kinds of things. So it might state quite clearly at the start what eligibility requirements are, and then gradually over time those change and they broaden to allow other people to access the law. And so they worry about vulnerable people in particular. And I think that's another concern all on its own, is around the concern for the most vulnerable people in society. Some people oppose assisted dying because of their faith-based beliefs, you know, religious beliefs. And some people have seen, you know, really good deaths and seen palliative care in action and just feel assisted dying isn't necessary. Interestingly on that point, some people who oppose assisted dying have actually witnessed and experienced, you know, the dying of others that has been particularly difficult, and because of that oppose assisted dying because they feel it could come to be abused, the practices could come to be abused.
Talking about that idea of the law being abused, is that in reference to perhaps it being abused by medical practitioners or family who may, you know, encourage a person to make that decision because perhaps they're a burden on the family, or there's some sort of, I don't know, monetary reason, or you know, some sort of inheritance backing behind coercion like that.
Look, it's a good question, and I think some people worry about all those things. But if you look at what the law is stating, what the law is saying for Kiwis, it's not just a doctor talking to a patient. The patient and the doctor making the decision and then the doctor doing it. It really is around consultation, conversation. It's around the doctor regularly talking with the patient about what they want and why. The doctor has to make sure the patient understands what they're asking and what other options are available. They also have to tell the patient that they can change their mind at any time, and if the patient makes any indication that they don't want to go ahead with it, then that has to be you know, agreed with. The doctor can't go ahead and just do it because the patient said at some point they wanted it. The doctor also has to encourage the person to speak to their family, and they don't have to do that if they don't want to, but that conversation has to have taken place. But I think one of the safeguards that's really important for people to understand is that the doctor has to, there has to be two doctors who agree on the patient's eligibility. So it requires two independent doctors to talk to the patient. If they are not in agreement about that, then a psychiatrist should be involved to make an assessment of the patient. In terms of family, so again, I think part of the doctor's role in discussing their request with the patient is to understand the reasons why they want this. And that's both doctors have to do that. So I think if there are concerns around a patient perhaps being pressured or influenced because the family perhaps want this person to die sooner rather than later, that's the kind of thing that I think is going to be foremost in a doctor's mind. Or a nurse practitioner, because they also can be involved in this process.
A number of health professionals and larger health groups, such as the New Zealand Medical Association, have opposed the Act, citing that euthanasia in any form conflicts with the ethical principles of medical practice and would change the fundamental role of the doctor and the doctor-patient relationship. I asked the Act party's Brooke van Velden about what her thoughts were on this issue.
Yeah, so the Medical Association, you're right, did come out against, but I think it was the general practitioners who came out neutral, saying that they had doctors in favour and doctors against. And it's the same within all groups of society. There isn't one group that's 100% against or 100% for. You've got doctors in favour, doctors against, Māori in favour, Māori against. You've got people even with terminal illnesses for and against this option. The important thing is to note that internationally, where these laws happen, doctor and patient relationships actually improve. So I think in the countries that have assisted dying laws,
there has not been a breakdown of doctor-patient relationship. In fact, it's improved. And I think it's really important to note that in some of the countries, the medical associations have actually changed their position. And it's going to be very tricky for any organisation where it's currently against the law, especially for assisted dying, for a doctor to say that they support it, because there is a fear of being a doctor and saying that you support an illegal practice. So definitely in the conversations I've had going around the community, there are doctors in favour, but they're just too afraid to say so at the moment.
I also spoke to Philippa Malpass from the medical school about whether this responsibility to assist someone to die changes the fundamental responsibility of a doctor to preserve life.
I know you've spoken a lot about, obviously, the responsibility that the medical practitioners have in their role in this person's choice to go through with assisted dying. I know doctors every day have a really responsible job. You know, you are dealing with somebody's life the majority of the time. Mm. But I suppose the thought is this is a responsibility with ending somebody's life rather than perhaps what is normally considered to be a responsibility of a doctor to preserve life. Do you think that that is a different responsibility that should be, I don't know, I just sort of think, is that something that potentially is a concern for doctors in themselves about, you know, that's changed the responsibility of a doctor?
Look, I think there'll be a lot of doctors and there'll be some nurse practitioners who won't want a bar of this. And they will say, for a whole variety of reasons, I don't want to be involved in this because I very much see my role as helping people to live the best lives they can. Other people, other doctors and nurse practitioners will see that this is part of their care of a patient, that it's actually been with them right to the very end. And I think it's important also to note that even though palliative care in New Zealand is excellent, and in fact in many parts of the world it's very, very good, it just can't respond to every instance of pain and suffering. And there are patients still in 2020 who die deaths that are difficult and challenging for them and their families and for the health practitioners as well. And so some doctors have said, in research that's been carried out, that actually they see assisting a patient at the very end to take control of their dying as part of their role, and it's part of not abandoning them at the very end. So I think it is a different kind of responsibility. I just don't think doctors would take this decision lightly. No doctor or nurse practitioner would take this decision lightly.
Yeah, because I suppose it is something that they also have to live with, you know, like it's not just something that they're like, oh, that's just ticked that off for the day. It's, you know, yes. it's quite a large decision to, you know, have that with you too.
It is. And I think if we look at what's been happening in the Netherlands, where assisted dying has been available for a couple of decades now, and in fact there was acceptance of it before it became legal, doctors there don't see this as part of normal medical practice. So this is different to normal medical practice. These are decisions that sit outside the norm. And, you know, I have spoken to health professionals in the Netherlands who have been involved in assisting patients to die, and they say emotionally, you know, it is grueling even when you've done it a few times. It's not something that you undertake lightly, and it takes you days sometimes to come back to that point of feeling back to where you were before. So I think it does have a toll. It does take a toll. And it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because that's the kind of doctor we want to be involved in this. We don't want somebody who doesn't see this as a challenging, difficult, emotionally hard decision to make. We want them to struggle with this because I think that shows that this is something that's not taken lightly.
I was particularly interested in the idea that if a doctor doesn't feel happy with assisted dying and they don't want to participate, whether they do have to. And Brooke van Velden did state that doctors will not be required or forced to participate in assisted dying if it is something they disagree with fundamentally.
would there be have to be a discussion about which doctors potentially are happy to provide this procedure, or whether there'd be some people that could opt out? Would that ever be a consideration for, you know, if it is a moral issue for people to be able to opt out if that isn't sort of the ethical code they stand by?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the main focus of this is all about choice and giving choice to the terminally ill, but also it's important that we're giving choice to the doctors so that they're not forced to go against their own conscience. So it's in the legislation that a doctor, if they're approached by a patient who asks about assisted dying, that they're able to say that they want nothing to do with it. So it's in the law already that they have what's called a conscientious objection, so that they can say, I understand that you've come to me wanting assisted dying, but this goes against my conscience. You're going to have to go and ask someone else. And it's really important that we're not forcing doctors to do something that they're not comfortable with.
Philippa Malpass from the medical school went on to discuss the concerns around the likelihood of a medical practitioner making a wrong judgment about a person's terminal illness and how long they have to live.
How likely is it that a medical professional could make a wrong decision or an incorrect judgment about how long somebody has to live? Because I suppose there's that argument that, you know, miracles happen every day. People, you know, people are told that they're only going to live for a couple of months, but then they live for a year, you know?
Yeah, and so the law is quite clear that there's a 6 month time frame here, so patients have to be within 6 months of being expected to die. And as you rightly say, sometimes these estimates are wrong. I think there are some safeguards around this, though, because it does require two doctors to be involved. And it's a decision that's made between the doctor and the patient. So the patient, right up until that, you know, 6 month period, can actually walk away from this decision and not have to go through with it. So there's no requirement that a person has to take the medication if they've been given the green light. And what we know from overseas, particularly in some of the American states, I'm thinking here of Oregon in particular, when we look at the statistics coming out of Oregon for the last 20 years, a number of people who get given the green light, so to speak, to be assisted to die, don't take it. So these are people who have the medication in their hand, literally, and don't take it. And I think some people change their mind because they have the means, they continue to live, and they see it almost as an insurance policy that when the going gets too tough, they can take it. And there'll be others for whom they just weren't given the opportunity. They maybe ended up going to hospital because they deteriorated and they didn't leave and the medication was at home. So, but I think what's interesting is a number of people have the medication and don't take it. So it's just not a done deal that if you get the green light because you're eligible, it's going to have to happen. And I think the worries around doctors making mistakes are probably mitigated by the fact that two have to be involved. And these are doctors and nurse practitioners who very much understand their patients, you know, and have known their patients and understand what their trajectory has been to date.
The final issue that I found particularly relevant to the end-of-life choice referendum, and also that has been brought up a lot in public discussion, is the fact that the cooling-off period between the request for assisted dying and the administration of the lethal drug in this Act is much shorter than it is in other jurisdictions. Under New Zealand's End-of-Life Choice Act, upon the approval of assisted dying and then the prescription of the lethal dose, there is only a requirement that a person waits 48 hours before the drug is administered. In Oregon and the United States, there is a 15-day cooling off period, and then also in Canada, there is a 9-day period. Philippa could not speak to why our period is shorter than other jurisdictions. However, she did explain that upon approval of assisted dying, a person is not required to die straight away. Under the Act, a person always has the right to change their mind within the 6-month period of their life expectancy.
if you get given the green light by the two doctors and potentially a psychiatrist, it's not like you have to just go, okay, boom, we're doing it tomorrow sort of thing. You can take as long as you like in the 6 month period.
Within the 6 month period, and you don't have to take it. And I think if a person continues to find pleasure in life and continues to feel that they want to live and that their quality of life is still acceptable to them, then they, you know, they won't take it, because this is really all about the patient themselves. So, you know, I guess it's going back to those concerns people have around undue pressure and coercion and influence to make somebody, you know, do it. I just think, even though that's a concern some people have, in reality, this is really about the relationship between the doctor and the patient, or the patient and the nurse practitioner, that it's the patient who's calling the shots here. And part of that process is talking through about where that person's at the moment. I think another thing that's important here too is that some people ask for what we know from the literature overseas is that some people make a request to a doctor for an assisted death, but in fact it's really it's almost like an invitation to have a conversation, to kind of put it out there and to see what happens. And many people, I think, when they're reassured about how their death and their dying is going to be managed, that request goes away, that it doesn't actually become something that the person continues to want to work towards. So I guess the point there is that at the moment, doctors can't have this conversation with their patients, and patients can't bring it up because it's not something that they're allowed to talk about. If it was available, I think patients would ask doctors, but not necessarily because they want it, but because they want to have a discussion about what their dying might look like, who will be there for them, how will it be managed, just to have that very frank kind of conversation. And I think that's a really good thing.
These have been some of the issues that have arisen around the referendum and the End of Life Choice Act 2019. I spoke to ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden and Associate Professor of Clinical Medical Ethics, Philippa Maldas, about the concerns around assisted dying and the Act.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.